Science is almost by definition anti-authoritarian. Successful scientists must see the world differently than those who came before them if they are to make new discoveries. Or as one of the most famous scientists of all times, Albert Einstein, famously said regarding his failure to do significant work in his later years, quote, "To punish me for my contempt of authority, fate has made me an authority myself," end quote. There is often tension between authority and science. Think of Galileo, the father of modern science, recanting his heliocentrism and spending the last years of his life under house arrest on orders of the Inquisition. Nowhere is this tension more palpable than between religion and biomedical science. Genesis 1:26 and 27 reads, "And God said, let us make man in our image after our likeness." With these ancient and enduring words, our view of ourselves and of our bodies was forever altered. Since God is infinite, and since we, unlike animals, are fashioned in God's image, human life was now of infinite value. It follows then that we don't own our bodies, but rather we are caretakers of our bodies, and we are obligated to take care of our bodies because they are made in the divine image of God. When we permit an idealistic and humanistic medical science to treat our bodies as something other than holy, we plant the seeds of scientific dehumanization that has led to a terrible harvest in the past. Consider body worlds. Described by its creator, German physician Günther von Hagens, as the first anatomical exhibition of preserved human bodies. The focus of this exhibition, seen by 25 million people worldwide, is some 200 genuine human bodies that have been plastinated. The process of plastination removes all residual fat and moisture from cadavers and replaces these components with plastic polymers with shrill neon colors that differentiate muscles, organs, and blood vessels. The cadavers are arranged in lifelike poses, rollerblading, horseback riding, dribbling a basketball, and in one particularly ghoulish display, a doleful cadaver holds up his own flayed skin as if deciding whether or not to send it to the cleaners. According to Michael J. Lewis, writing about body worlds in Commentary Magazine, quote, "The way a body is treated aesthetically is always an index of society's understanding of itself. If our bodies do in fact comprise ourselves, it is little wonder that they have come to dominate so many of the political and legal battles of our time over birth control, abortion, suicide, euthanasia, organ donation, elective amputation, and more. This development in itself suggests a vast cultural change in our understanding of the body, its autonomy, and its moral relationship to society," end quotes. We rely on religious institutions to remind us that all human life is of infinite value and that science is not our salvation. But sometimes our faith in religious institutions is not justified. In their book, Betrayal, German Churches and the Holocaust, Robert Erickson and Susanna Heschel contend that, quote, "The German churches played a far more important role in Nazi atrocities than has hitherto been supposed. Most important, their role involved moral suasion. Through the support for Nazi policies articulated by many religious leaders, ordinary Germans were reassured that these policies did not violate the tenets of Christian faith and morality," end quotes. Lest you think this was only taking place in Germany, we have in another book, Preaching Eugenics, Religious Leaders and the American Eugenics Movement, the author Christine Rosen saying about Sinclair Lewis's fictitious Dr. Arrowsmith, quote, "Like so many pulpit Arrowsmiths, preachers had become enamored of the possibilities science presented. In eugenics, they found a science whose message moved effortlessly from laboratory to church." When religious institutions lose their way, is it reasonable to expect scientists and physicians to find the right path? As Henri Lubach wrote in Le Drama de l'Humanitisme Anthé, Reflections on Europe's Civilizational Crisis, quotes, "It is not true, as it is sometimes said, that man cannot organize the world without God. What is true is that without God, he can only organize it against man," end quotes. Tonight, we are blessed with two theologians who will give us their views on science, medicine, and religion after the Holocaust. Our first speaker will be Dr. John Haas, president of the National Catholic Bioethics Center in Philadelphia. The center was established in 1972 to apply the teachings of the Catholic Church to ethical issues arising from developments in medicine, the life sciences, and civil law. It is the largest publisher of books and periodicals on Catholic bioethics in the country. Dr. Haas received his PhD in moral theology from the Catholic University of America, and his STL, don't feel embarrassed if you don't know what an STL is, I didn't either, I had to go look it up. It's a licentiate in sacred theology. How'd I do? Thank you. In moral theology from the University of Freiburg, Switzerland. He also has a Master of Divinity degree and has studied at the University of Munich and the University of Chicago Divinity School. Before assuming the presidency of the National Catholic Bioethics Center, Dr. Haas was the John Cardinal Kroll Professor of Moral Theology at St. Charles Borromeo Seminary of the Archdiocese of Philadelphia, an adjunct professor at the Pontifical John Paul II Institute for Studies in Marriage and the Family in Washington, D.C. He has also served as a member of the Medical Moral Commission of the Archdiocese of Philadelphia, a faculty member of the Commission for Interprofessional Education and Practice at Ohio State University, professor of moral theology at the Pontifical College Josephinum in Worthington, Ohio, and has testified before governmental and advisory bodies on physician-assisted suicide and cloning of humans. Dr. Haas has written many articles on topics ranging from the role of the laity in the church, to sexual morality, social justice issues, and bioethics for crisis of conscience, Christian marriage, a historical study, and Crisis, the St. Austin Review, and Touchstone magazines. He has written Marriage and the Priesthood and Contraception, a Personal Odyssey. And his opinion pieces have appeared in the New York Times, the Boston Globe, and the Philadelphia Inquirer. Dr. Haas has lectured extensively in the United States and abroad, and is a consultant to the Committee for Pro-Life Activities of the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, a former board member of the Fellowship of Catholic Scholars, and a board member and faculty member of the International Catholic University. His recent awards include the honorary degree of Doctor of Christian Ethics by the Franciscan University of Steubenville, an honorary Doctor of Laws by Immaculata University, and election to the board of the International Federation of Bioethics Centers and Institutes of Personalist Inspirations. In November of 2004, he became a Knight of the Sovereign Military Order of St. John of Jerusalem and of Malta, and in 2006, Pope Benedict XVI appointed him to the Vatican's Pontifical Academy for Life as an ordinary member. In his spare time, Dr. Haas founded and was president of the International Institute for Culture based in Philadelphia, and for a number of years he produced and hosted a national television program known as the St. Charles Forum. In the early 80s, Dr. Haas was a registered foreign agent for the National Bank of Mexico and executive director of Banamex Cultural Foundation, and served as a consultant to the Department of Justice on Hispanic and family issues during the first Reagan administration. As if he were not busy enough, somehow Dr. Haas and his wife, Martha, have 9 children and several grandchildren. Tonight, he will speak about science, medicine, and religion after the Holocaust. Please join me in welcoming the very energetic Dr. John Haas, the Holocaust Museum.
Thank you very much, Doctor. I mean, after that introduction, I can only use 2 pages of my address. I mean, there's no time left. But it's a great honor for me to be with you. It's a joy. It's a real privilege. I bring you greetings from Bishop Morlino, who is the chairman of our board and the Bishop of Madison, Wisconsin. and also from another one of our board members, His Eminence Cardinal Francis George, who has just been elected the president of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops and is the Cardinal Archbishop of Chicago. So I extend his greetings to you as well. Another interesting note is we're here in Houston. The founding president of the National Catholic Bioethics Center was a man who taught pharmacology at Baylor Medical School and then became a Dominican priest. And I was going to go, he's in a nursing home now, and I was going to go visit him, but my flight was so delayed I didn't have that opportunity, which I regret. But I do thank you very much for being here with you. I spent a lot of time with physicians, as you can imagine. A friend of mine was telling me the story of these two little boys are out in the playground. I spent a lot of time with little boys, but and little girls and grandchildren, 14 now. But anyway, one little boy said to the other, I hear you're going into the hospital. And the other kid says, yeah, I do. The other boy says, what are you going in for? And the other kid says, well, you know, I have to have an operation. And the other kid said, oh, no, really? I mean, what kind of operation are you going to have? And the other boy says, well, I'm going to have a circumcision. The other kid said, oh, that's awful, circumcision. He said, that's a terrible operation. He said, I had a circumcision when I was one day old and I didn't walk for a year. Some audiences get nervous when I start with a circumcision joke, but I mean, I think it works out all right. Well, science, medicine, and religion are powerful social forces. The Hippocratic Oath itself, the foundational document of ethical medical practice, calls upon deities to witness to the taking of it. I swear by Apollo the physician and Asclepius and Hygieia and Panacea and all the gods and goddesses, making them my witnesses, that I will fulfill according to my ability and judgment this oath and this covenant. In the Catholic Church, another religious body, one can certainly see this natural and enduring relationship between religion and medical science. The Church has a very long history with healthcare. The founder of our religion referred to himself as a physician and gained great notoriety in his own day for his acts of healing. From the beginning, the Church committed itself to carrying forward the healing ministry of Jesus. Communities of religious sisters and brothers and priests started hospitals and orphanages and asylums and leprosariums. Such initiatives have continued to grow so that in our day, the Catholic Church is the largest provider of non-governmental health care in the United States, generating $90 billion a year in revenue and holding over $200 billion in assets. Furthermore, Catholics involved in healthcare for the sick and dying had no problem whatever embracing the pagan Hippocratic Oath, committing themselves never to violate a patient entrusted to their care. One can even find early Christian manuscripts with this pagan oath written in the form of a cross. And our last pope, John Paul II, referred to, quote, the still relevant Hippocratic Oath, which requires every doctor to commit himself or herself to absolute respect for human life and its sacredness, end quote. And here I believe we find the absolute touchstone of the enduring commitment on the part of science, medicine, and religion in its highest forms, and that is to this absolute respect for human life and its sacredness of each individual human life. Those with ultimate responsibility for this vast healthcare ministry in the Church are the bishops, who have issued something known as the Ethical and Religious Directives for Catholic Healthcare Services. And in the introduction to that work, they state the centerpiece of this vast ministry. Catholic healthcare ministry is rooted in a commitment to promote and defend human dignity. This is the foundation of its concern to respect the sacredness of every human life from the moment of conception until death. End quote. It is this uncompromising commitment to the dignity of each living human being that can save healthcare from ever being put to sinister and disordered purposes, as has happened more than once in history. In the Germany of National Socialism, everyone and everything came to be ordered to the good of the state, not the individual, and violations of human dignity followed as night the day. To gain a better understanding of how the medical profession could have become so corrupted by National Socialism, one must place it in a larger historical context. And I know you've dealt with the history over and over at these workshops and lectures, but I want to touch on certain elements that and draw in aspects of our own church's response to what was happening. The late 19th, so we can't see this either as simply a rising in Nazi Germany. The late 19th century had seen the rise of eugenics movements not only in Germany, but in the United States and England as well. A corruption of the medical profession had actually begun well before Hitler's rise to power. A movement known as social Darwinism had spread throughout Europe and America. It was thought that nations, as well as species, were engaged in a struggle that led to the survival of the fittest. The fittest nations would be those that were genetically most pure and robust. Indeed, as early as 1865, the eugenics movement had been initiated by Sir Francis Galton, the cousin of Charles Darwin. It drew many prominent individuals, including George Bernard Shaw, Alexander Graham Bell, and Margaret Sanger, the founder of Planned Parenthood. International eugenics conferences were held in London in 1912 and in New York in 1921 and 1933. In Germany, race theorists developed concepts and programs to advance these essentially disordered medical or biological views. The Kaiser Wilhelm Society operated between 1911 and 1940 and was perhaps the most prestigious scientific organization in Germany. It focused heavily on the so-called science of genetics. It is clear that the Jews were not the only ones subjected to National Socialist racist theories that were a natural, though abhorrent, outgrowth of social Darwinism. The degenerate races included the Africans, Gypsies, and Slavs. These came to be known as the Untermenschen, the subhumans. But even here, we find that the concept was not isolated and hardly exclusive to the National Socialists. The first use of the term Untermenschen, or under man, was by an American, Lothrop Stoddard, in a 1922 book that consisted of a tirade against the degenerate Slavs who had taken power in the Soviet Union as the Bolsheviks. It was entitled The Revolt Against Civilization, The Menace of the Underman, and was published by the quite reputable publishing house of Charles Scribner's Sons in New York. It argued that if the white race was going to win the struggle against the inferior races, it must eschew liberal policies and adopt an expansive eugenics program. His book was published in Germany in 1925 as Der Kulturumsturz, Die Drohung des Untermenschen, and the term and concept of the Untermensch were soon taken up by the Nazi apologists. The fact that physicians constituted the largest professional group among the Nazis may be attributable in part to the fact that National Socialism had a sort of pseudoscience as an integral part of its political program that grew out of the eugenics movement. As Dr. Ernst points out, Hitler frequently referred to the Jewish race in medical terms as bacillus, parasite, or disease. His followers adopted these medical analogies. In their minds, the biological body of the German people was threatened by the Jews, end quote. In fact, a German document in 1935 declared, quote, the maintenance of a genetically homogeneous and healthy stock of the German people is the main duty of the German physician, end quote. Race hygiene had been developed by and had come under the purview of the medical profession. As Ernst puts it, to a large degree, the medical profession was not politicized, but politics were medicalized, end quote. As soon as Hitler came to power in 1933, a law requiring forced sterilization for eugenic purposes was passed. Such a law was considered necessary to save German blood from further contamination. In 1934 alone, over 56,000 people were involuntarily sterilized as a result of decrees from what were known as genetic health courts. Now, to my mind, it's worthy of note that there were inevitably attempts to provide the appearance of morality and legality and due process of law for even the most inhumane and unjust actions. As abhorrent as this is, as Catholics, we believe that something good can be seen here. We hold to a theory, if you will, known as the natural moral law. We believe that there is a moral law that is written by God in the hearts of all human beings, so that when that moral law is violated, there is always an awareness of the violation at some level. Why else would the Nazis have devised the appearances of morality and due process and legality to justify unspeakably inhumane behaviors? There was a Jewish teacher 2 millennia ago, Saul or Paul of Tarsus, who wrote a letter to the Romans and alluded to this reality. For when the Gentiles, who do not have the law, by nature observe the prescriptions of the law, they show that the demands of the law are written in their hearts. In fact, we would maintain that the attempt on the part of the National Socialist and other criminal and social movements to justify their behaviors in terms of morality is an attestation to this law. Indeed, it is the basis of good that has come out of the aftermath of that horrible time in human history. It is the basis of international law, and it provided a legitimacy for the Nuremberg trials and its judgments of crimes against humanity after the war. But back to the genetic health courts. The National Socialists soon became convinced that these genetic health courts were not sufficient to address the drain of national resources posed by those in German society who were considered defective. In October of 1939, Hitler quietly established a broad euthanasia program to dispose of children with Down syndrome, hydrocephaly, and other anomalies. He wrote, "Reichsleiter Buhler and Dr. Medzen Brandt are commissioned with the responsibility of extending the authority of specified doctors so that, after critical assessment of their condition, those adjudged incurably ill can be granted mercy death," end quote. Once again, we see an appeal to a purported medical and judicial process leading to the direct killing of the innocent. And this appeal was cloaked in the language of morality and decency, in this case, mercy death. By the end of the year, the euthanasia program was extended to adults suffering from lives not worth living, das lebensunwerte Leben, that became a leitmotif in German nationalist socialist ideology. However, despite Hitler's written order, the program was still being carried out surreptitiously, and most of the general population knew nothing of it. Even as late as 1939, the Nazis were aware that the public was not prepared to accept euthanasia, particularly those who were practicing Christians. Hitler quite consciously avoided introducing a program of euthanasia throughout the 30s because he did not want to provoke the condemnation of the Catholic Church. Here can be seen the value of there being competing or complementary institutions within a society providing some sort of checks and balances. Here we can see the usefulness of a certain pluralism within the social order. In this case, there is a brutal dictatorship that did not dare undertake certain courses of action because of its fear of losing its hold on power or because of its fear that it could not effectively carry out its programs with that kind of opposition. Within a year after the National Socialists came to power in 1933, Cardinal Michael von Faulhaber of Munich warned publicly of a growing sentiment in German society toward euthanasia and of policies within the National Socialist Party. He wrote to the head of the Reich Chancellery, "I have deemed it my duty to speak out against this ethical, legal, non-political question, for as a Catholic bishop, I may not remain silent when the preservation of the moral foundations of all public order is at stake," end quote. Despite such an objection in 1934, in 1935, the leader of the Reich's doctors, Gerhard Wagner, went on to push for the widespread destruction of life not worth living. However, he maintained later that Hitler told him not to undertake such a program during peacetime. Hitler supported such an initiative, of course, but he was, and I quote Wagner, of the opinion that such a program could be more smoothly and easily carried out in war, and that the expected resistance from the churches would have less impact in wartime. Of course, that is precisely what Hitler did. But even before the war broke out, the National Socialists were working toward their eugenics objectives. From 1936, all church institutions were forced to transfer the patients in their sanatoria to asylums controlled by the state. And already in this period, certain patients were being subjected to so-called mercy death. Astonishingly, the entire euthanasia program, which began in 1939 and ended in 1941 and had claimed more than 90,000 lives, was carried out secretly and with no claim to legality. Euphemisms, again, were used for its implementation, a perverted appeal to a universal moral order that could be sensed at some depths of these people's beings. Questionnaires to determine which patients should be euthanized were distributed by the Reich Association of Asylums, and the means of transportation of these unfortunate individuals to their deaths was known as the community patients transport. By the beginning of 1941, rumors had become increasingly widespread that the National Socialist regime was engaged in a euthanasia program in the asylums throughout the country. On the 7th of July of that year, the German bishops issued a pastoral letter to be read from all pulpits, declaring that it was immoral to kill except in a just war or in self-defense. They maintained that there were, quote, obligations of conscience, end quote, that led them to oppose the direct taking of innocent human life, quote, even if it were to cost us our own lives, end quote. It was a clear condemnation of the clandestine killings that were thought to be taking place in the asylums. But then about a month later, on the 3rd of August, Bishop Clemens August, Count von Galen, the Bishop of